Welcome back to Down the Rabbit Hole. I'm Jason.
And I'm Jake.
Last week, we started our foreign policy lookbacks with President Barack Obama's choices in the Middle East. Jake gave him a C+ overall. I gave him a very low B-. Mostly what hurt Obama's grade is the wishy-washiness, for lack of a better term. Condemning something over there, but then doing it over here. Today, we're tackling President Obama's Russian reset and pivot to the Pacific policies. So let's see if President Obama suffers the same problems.
So I'm going to make the executive decision for us to start with reset and Russia.
Oh, man, you know, I didn't see that one coming, and I don't even know if I have to talk.
Yeah, I'll handle this. But before I dive in, quick note, when Barack Obama is a candidate at the time, the Russian invasion of Georgia is taking place. He makes strong statements on the campaign trail condemning Russian action in Georgia and then did not punish Russia significantly for their invasion when he assumes office.
So for background, Russia and Georgia fought a brief war in August of 2008. Russia invaded and occupied Abkhazia and South Ossetia, two autonomous nations in Georgia. The war ended fairly quickly, but Russia kept a military presence in those two regions. Obama's lack of punishment that Jake hit on were a direct connection to his Russian reset policy. So talk to me more about that.
Two regions in Georgia, not nations, correct?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say nations? Yeah, they're two autonomous regions within Georgia.
Okay, so President Obama takes office. He's greeted with Dmitry Medvedev, who is the leader of Russia at the time, aka Vladimir Putin's puppet. To hit it off, he and Obama make good progress. They seem to get along. And Obama really promises a fresh start to U.S.-Russia relations.
I mean, Putin's puppet is certainly a way to put it. But anyway, this is where we get the infamous reset button debacle.
Yes, unfortunately, this is where we get the reset button debacle. So Hillary Clinton, who is Secretary of State at the time, meets with her Russian counterpart and presents him with basically a glorified Staples that was easy button meant to say reset in Russian. One problem, though, the State Department completely screws it up, and it actually says overcharge or overload, depending on your Russian dialect. The two laugh it off, but it's pretty symbolic for what's about to happen.
I guess you would think the State Department would have somebody double-check that.
Or triple-check it, you know.
But walk me through the Obama administration's thought process for going through this reset.
Yeah, that's a good point. We can't really have anything without a foundation. Obama really saw and I guess identified a dangerous rift between Russia and the U.S. growing. He tried to find mutually beneficial topics of agreement for government-to-government discussion. He tried to have American and Russian civil societies engage more and really an increase in U.S.-Russian business, education, and organizational contacts. But he then goes on to go as far to say that he wants a strong, peaceful, and prosperous Russia when speaking with Putin and Medvedev in 2009.
So, I mean, do we get that kind of cooperation?
Yes, but not before Vice President at the time, Biden, gets himself into trouble in Moscow by saying, quote, with its population base shrinking and economy withering, Russia would have to make accommodations to the West on a wide range of national security issues.
Joe. Can't we always just count on Joe?
But to answer your question, we did get some cooperation. We get the New START Treaty, Strategic Arms Reduction, in 2010, that reduces both the state stockpiles of nuclear weapons.
I mean, that was pretty big. It reduced U.S. and Russian deployed strategic warheads by about 33%. Numbers came down to 1,550 deployed strategic warheads, 700 delivery vehicles, and 800 total intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, and heavy nuclear bombers. These numbers might sound big, but they're actually much smaller than they were in the past. That's all good, though, right?
Yes. I mean, yes, but we know there were some clever loopholes that allow each to have more than those numbers, so its effect is debatable, but the principle is good, yes.
Okay, that's a fair point. But there are other examples of cooperation, too. Obama chose not to increase missile defenses in Eastern Europe. Russia allowed U.S. air traffic through Russian airspace en route to Afghanistan. Russia supported U.S. efforts to condemn and sanction North Korea for its nuclear test in May of 2009. Obama dropped a lot of sanctions. They actually both put sanctions on Iran. In 2010, the U.S. extradited a Russian spy ring back to Russia. And we can't forget that the U.S. actually helped Russia with its World Trade Organization accession. I mean, that all sounds like things are going in the right direction.
Sort of. I mean, we can't undermine the merits of those examples you just mentioned. Those are good things for the most part. But in around 2012, Russia is now engaged in a mini democracy crisis, with Putin set to come back into power in 2012. This makes Obama and the states very nervous. You can probably see why. And it's really highlighted by Biden saying that he thought it would be better for Russia if Putin did not run in 2012. He also apparently said, this is coming from his own biography, he said to Putin's face, quote, "I don't think you have a soul," which is referencing that famous George Bush quote where he says he looked into Putin's eyes and saw the soul of a good man or something like that. But that's utterly hilarious.
I'm literally rubbing my temples right now. Like, things you shouldn't say to another world leader's face for 600. Like, what?
Yes, exactly. But this really comes to a head when during Putin's presidential campaign in 2012, he accuses the U.S. of interfering in the Russian electoral process, how ironic, and inciting unrest. He's very hard on Secretary of State Clinton and basically claims that Reset was a front to get him out of the picture.
We had mentioned last episode that Russia gets involved in Syria not too long after this, when Putin comes back into power. Although Russia claims to want to work with the U.S. and fight terrorism, they did spend more time bombing U.S.-backed rebels.
Yeah, and then Putin basically one-ups Obama by quote-unquote dealing with Syria's chemical weapons. That results in Obama not following through on his own red line.
And you can see how Putin coming back into power kind of influences this Russian Reset decline. But, I don't know, are we missing something? Like, I don't know, Snowden? Russia did grant Snowden asylum. We're pretty much, I don't know, adrift, dead in the water here when we're talking about the Reset.
Oh, yeah, and then Crimea.
Oh, God, that big oof on that one.
Yeah, we're going to spare the details on Crimea. We've covered it about a half dozen times. You can see previous episodes if you want to catch up there. But good key point here. We now have John Kerry as Secretary of State. He calls the Crimean incident 18th century behavior. And then the U.S. leads an effort to kick Russia out of the G8.
And I'm pretty sure Putin said to the press that Russia's removal was inconsequential, and that's kind of wild.
Yeah, that is one of my favorite Putin quotes. And then it's kind of like, this is where the tit for tat really starts, right? We're going to use that term a lot in this episode. Obama goes on to say that the 2014 Crimea annexation would be hard to undo. He dismisses military action, which is obviously the right thing to do, and declares that Russia is, quote, a regional power who does not pose a serious security threat to the United States. Whoops. Oh, yeah, and we tossed some pity sanctions on Russia for their actions in Crimea.
All right, so I said that the Russian Reset was kind of dead in the water, but now we see that the Reset just didn't pan out. Mm-hmm. We're not done with Russia, though. Let's jump to 2015. We're going to revisit Syria. Some people call this a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia.
Yeah, again, we'll spare the details here, just go over the key points. Russia's basically starting a bombing campaign in Aleppo. Obama calls it a recipe for disaster and rules out any military cooperation with Russia. The Pentagon also may or may not have been briefing that Russia was attempting to prop up Assad, who is obviously no friend of Obama's, as we know from last week. That's kind of where you get the proxy war tension, with Obama being very interested in removing Assad from power. We know he calls for his removal, or for him to step down. Removal's a strong term. And then you kind of have Putin propping him up. So not really two peas in a pod here, Russia and the U.S. on Syria.
If you want more information, just go back to last week's episode when we actually cover the web of confusion, was the term I used to describe it, with all of the players in Syria and what was going on.
Can we trademark that? That should be our new podcast name.
Web of Confusion? Honestly, yes. It's fitting. Anyway, so this all results in more awkward tension between Putin and Obama. We get both of them calling the other out for violating past agreements. There were secret meetings and the now infamous sideline meeting at the G20 summit. Disagreements on Syria continue in bilateral and multilateral negotiations. And at this point, late 2015, early 2016, right at the end of Obama's tenure, U.S.-Russia relations are kind of as tense as they were since the Cold War.
Yeah, you use the word awkward, or the phrase awkward tension, which I love. There's a senior Obama official who I can't remember if he's named or unnamed, but they basically say that this person has never seen two men who feel as awkward in each other's presence as Putin and Obama do. So that really sums up where we're at.
It's kind of like 2015. It's kind of like high school movie comedy right there.
Yeah, yeah. You get the jock and maybe the nerd, but we're not going to place any roles in anybody. And then in 2016, towards the end of Obama's tenure, we get the presidential election interference, the DNC hacks, WikiLeaks, but we're not going to open that can of worms.
I mean, not in this set. We have covered those extensively before.
Yes. Okay. Give me your Russia grades.
Okay. So 2008 to 2012, I think it looks very promising. There was a lot of ground made that we talked about, and I have to give Obama credit here, but when we look at what happened from 2012 to 2016, my overall grade is a D, just a flat D.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be a little bit more pessimistic, shocker. I'm going to give it an F. I think the inception of reset is slightly confusing, just because it's one of those things where you're going to be hard-handed, but you're not. And the thing that really stinks to me about this is just the focus on strategic arms reduction and nuclear as the underpinning, which I think is dated and played out. The Crimea response is not great. The tit-for-tat regarding Syria and just kind of taking jabs at each other, it just wasn't really handled that well.
I really want to push back on the Russian reset idea because I think that the progress that was made when Medvedev, I'm sorry, I butchered that name. I don't know why I can't say it. But between him and Obama, I think there was a lot of tangible progress, diplomatic progress made. And I really do want to give President Obama credit because bringing Russia, who the Soviet Union collapsed and Russia went through a very difficult time trying to rebuild itself. And I think Obama was correct in trying to bring Russia, as it was rising back to be a global player, back into the liberal order, was a good idea. But Putin is really when things start going downhill in 2012.
And that's why I think it's short-sighted, because you know Putin's going to come back. Even if you don't think he's coming back, you know he's still running the show. So you're cooperating with Medvedev, your favorite guy.
My favorite guy.
But it's just like you don't see the bigger picture. That's my critique, anyways.
And then we have the Ukraine crisis really just has long-lasting strategic implications that Obama didn't address correctly.
Okay, but with any discussion of Russia, we also need to talk about NATO. On the campaign trail, President Obama did ask or talk about NATO's indispensable role in bringing Europe and the U.S. together to, you know, secure and stabilize the transatlantic or whatever's in the NATO charter. He supported NATO enlargement during his tenure. In 2009, NATO did add Albania and Croatia to its ranks, but there's a shift during his presidency, right?
Definitely a shift. Now, some analysts, looking back, call Obama the least Atlanticist president since NATO's creation. Atlanticist essentially means very pro-European-American cooperation. Obama was not antagonistic towards NATO. I mean, that's important to say. He actually had a very good working relationship with the political side of the body. But his attention did move. His 2012 strategic guidance suggested a pivot to the Pacific policy, like we're going to cover later. This is the shift we're talking about. And it was part of the reason that Obama moved resources away from Europe. In total, troop numbers in Europe fell to 30,000. Major General Robert Scales noted that this number was less than the number of police in New York City, and that statistic kind of puts it into perspective.
Yeah, that is a wild stat. But Jesus Christ, you know, that is ridiculous. We were just talking about Syria and Russia, but that story also ties into NATO. I mean, some of the alliance members were concerned that the U.S. was so focused on persuading Russia to help fight against ISIS, that America might be less willing to do what is necessary to head off Putin's encroachment, particularly on NATO's northern flank. We're talking the Baltic nations of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and then also countries like Poland.
And that's a big deal for NATO, right? But NATO's sole purpose is to deter Russia. The missile defense assets that Obama didn't send to Europe, which we were talking about before, well, they were supposed to go to Poland, and Poland was not happy about that decision. You can see how Obama's pursuit of the Russian reset caused a bit of anxiety in the Baltic NATO states.
Yeah, another important point is that Obama really pressured NATO states to spend more on defense. People think Trump was the big bad wolf for doing this, but Obama did it too. I mean, admittedly, Trump kind of took it to the nth degree, but it had to start somewhere.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. He put many NATO members on blast in a news conference, and I'm going to pull a direct Obama quote. He said, "I want to take this opportunity to commend Greece for being one of five NATO allies that spends 2% of GDP on defense, a goal that we have consistently set, but not everybody has met." I mean, that's a very clear statement.
Yes, we'll walk that clear statement into our grades of Obama's handling of NATO. I mean, I just think this is a middle-of-the-road type grade here. Nothing really stands out as being overly good or bad. I really do like his transparency in terms of defense spending and asking for more. It really comes down to, I guess, how pure of a NATO-ist you want to be, if that's a term. But I just think that the missile movement to Poland is kind of – or non-missile movement to Poland is somewhat understandable given the reset with Russia, whether or not you agree with that or not. It makes sense. I think it's a B.
I'm going to have to agree. It wasn't good and it wasn't bad, I think, is an accurate summation. I think his desire to ease tensions with Russia and, of course, his movement to the Pacific it kind of soured relations a little bit with Europe and NATO, right? He moved resources from Europe to other places on the globe. But again, Obama was not antagonistic towards NATO. He didn't ridicule them. I think he played it like he was a pretty good politician, right?
Yeah.
He did things that they didn't like, but also kept them as a friendly partner.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. I would also say that we often use hindsight to be critical, but now that we have a president who's taking a harsher stance on NATO, it looks like Obama maybe walked the line better than others. I'll leave it at that.
That's a good point.
Okay, so before we do our own pivot to the Pacific, I want to mention one other thing, and that's Cuba. Funnily enough, the Pope is involved in this story. Since around 2013, the U.S. and Cuba were holding secret meetings, one of which took place in the Vatican after the Pope requested the two countries exchange prisoners as a token of good faith.
I'm going to stop letting you make puns.
Okay, so the Great Thaw, as it's known, restored Cuban and American relations after 60 years, resulted in two embassies being opened, and Obama being the first president to visit Cuba since Calvin Coolidge in what year, Jason?
It was before the Great Depression. I know that. Right. I think it was like in the 20s, like the late
1928. Okay, 1928. There you go. Okay, but in general, the restoration of relations with Cuba is a pretty cool little tidbit and some really good work here from the Obama administration that I think is worth mentioning.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up. The Washington Post actually called this moment the official end of the Cold War, which is like a big statement, really. Mm. I think this was a necessary step forward that took too long. I have to give credit to President Obama here, right? Establishing diplomatic relations comes with a pile of positive externalities that, I don't know, I think critics don't acknowledge enough.
Yeah, this is just a quick A, right? Like, you get a little pop quiz, 5 out of 5, we keep moving.
Yeah, 100% agree is an A.
Okay, so let's talk East Asia and the Pacific. I want to start with the Hillary Clinton speech.
Man, Hillary Clinton is everywhere.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's... say what you want about Hillary Clinton and her politics, but the fact that she's at the focal point of a lot of these issues we're talking about, I think speaks volumes about the administration. We've talked about her in Benghazi. We've talked about her in Syria. We've talked about her in Russia. Now we're going to talk about her in China. So, you know, she is the Secretary of State after all, but she is literally entangled in everything.
And when we talk about Secretaries of State, Hillary Clinton was involved in a number of, I guess, pivotal moments.
I mean, she's up there with Kissinger in terms of like things she did. Like, I'm not if they're on the same level of being good as Kissinger, but the amount of ground she's covering, really.
Yeah.
Like, do you know who's Trump's Secretary of State when he got elected?
Wait, it was Rex Tillerson, wasn't it?
Yeah. See, like, there's levels to the Secretary of State. What I'm getting at here. Okay, so Clinton goes on to really set the tone for the pivot to the Pacific. She basically says that although China is on the rise, they are not to be considered an adversary, and it's a perfect time to embark on a new mission of cooperation, and the two states can really empower each other's success. She's also responsible for that buzzword pivot, so we got to give her credit for that at least.
So in 2010 to like the 2012 timeframe, the Obama administration has some specific topics. We have a lot of tongue twisters today that they want to address. Those were strengthening bilateral security alliances, working with emerging powers like China, expanding trade and investment, forging a broad-based military presence in the Pacific, and advancing democracy and human rights.
Sorry. So Obama pursued a pivot to East Asia to focus on these topics in the region, specifically concerning nations like China, Japan, North Korea, and South Korea.
Let's just start with China, I guess the big name on that list. An important point here is that during Obama's first term, China was still rising. It held substantial promise, but was not yet the power that it is today. The Chinese were not peers or near peers with the U.S. in terms of overall strength. So the CCP criticized Obama's 2012 strategic guidance as essentially a containment policy aimed at stifling China. Now, that policy did support a rebalance to Asia to address the rising China. Got it. This is all in context of Secretary Clinton's statement that China was not an adversary, but a potential partner. To be fair, it also said other things. It put greater focus on great power relations. It cautioned against American interventions, invasions, and meddling in far-off conflicts. And most importantly, it chastised long-term stability operations as determinants of American force posture. We really can't ignore those other conclusions.
No, that's a really good point. And it actually suggests that the crux of the problem between China and the U.S. is really a trust deficit, and it's only fueled by the events we're about to discuss. So to get into it, in 2012, really at the height of the pivot, or the beginning of the pivot, excuse me, China cut back purchases of Iranian oil. And in 2013, the two nations agreed to pursue harsher sanctions on North Korea for their nuclear program. And those are some signs of cooperation on really important issues.
Yeah, promising. And I like that you brought up the trust deficit. Xi Jinping and Barack Obama sat down with each other in 2013, and we see some interesting things coming from this. The two agree that cooperation is needed to tackle climate change, and they seem to be in agreement about curbing North Korea's nuclear program, but, and there's always a but, right? They were very far apart on issues of cybersecurity and intellectual property theft, or IPT. So these issues contributed specifically to the trust problem. IPT was becoming a focal point for the Obama administration because China had an extensive history, still does, of stealing R&D data from U.S. companies. There's also tension about U.S. military presence in the Pacific, which touches back to the containment view, and U.S. arms sales to Taiwan.
So the divide is really clear, I think, at this point. The two were together on basically multilateral issues, climate change, but very far apart on bilateral stuff because the two nations couldn't trust each other.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And this becomes even more clear as we continue down the timeline. In 2015, Obama's Secretary of Defense at the time, Ash Carter, takes a clear stance on island building in the South China Sea. I mean, he basically tells China to knock it off. The background here is that China was building artificial islands in the South China Sea. They called this land reclamation. Okay. Analysts say that China was trying to lay claim to the waters by building islands. The South China Sea is a heavily trafficked section of the ocean.
Yeah, that gets into the economic zones of how far out of your country you can go and all that good stuff that they're trying to take advantage of right there. But Obama did get Xi to back down from the South China Sea for a while in what was considered a pretty big win for the administration, but it didn't really halt. China continued to ramp up in the South China Sea, and it's very much still a problem today, as we know with freedom of navigation operations and the like. Oh yeah, and those islands, they're still in use. China does use them. I saw a quote the other day, someone talking about how there's a new airstrip on a man-made island about once a month in the South China Sea.
That's actually, I didn't see that, but once a month is a, that's pretty aggressive.
It was a little dated, so around 2018.
Okay. So we're moving now to the end of Obama's second term, 2015, 2016. China is now a significant global player. Its regional influence is growing. Its global influence is growing, both rapidly. To Obama's credit, his administration did try to answer China's economic rise. People say, oh, Obama did nothing. But we have to give Obama's administration some fairness here. The U.S. brought many cases to the World Trade Organization through trade enforcement actions. The U.S. penalized Russia through 370 different trade remedy orders. They launched action to target China's non-transparent and unfair tariff rate quotas, and they also challenged restrictions, duties, and tax inconsistencies.
Was that your impression of Senate Republicans on display there?
I could get much worse, but let's say yes here.
Okay, well, that really ties into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade recommendations you were making there. And this free trade agreement was originally politically neutral, but when China established the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank in early 2016, Obama saw it as an attempt to rewrite the global rules of engagement, and TPP negotiations turned into a method to block out China.
So we're going to... We're not going to go into the minutiae of the details in the TPP and negotiations and all of it. It was a good trade and diplomatic boost. It was supposed to be free trade linking North America to Asian countries that specifically didn't include China. But as we know, the Trump administration pulled right out of it.
Yeah, and that kind of contributes to my overall grade, not as much as previous short-sighted things, but let's get into that. I'm going to give China a B- in terms of how the Obama administration handled it. I very much like the strong stance on issues of cybersecurity and intellectual property theft. What I don't like is the lack of follow-through and simply relying on international institutions to pick up the buck there. I think the South China Sea issue was a little bit more confusing at the time than it is now. So there's definitely a little bit of a cop-out there. The exponential rise that China experienced during Obama's tenure really complicates things. So again, a little bit of a cop-out there. I also think that the decision to make the pivot is a strong one. The follow-through, maybe not as much, but you kind of throw Russia to the wayside or the back burner there. That comes back to bite you in the butt, but that's hindsight at its peak. So I think the decision to pivot is okay. Maybe not pivot as hard as the administration did, but some of the follow-through is a little bit weak, which is why I end around a B-.
I'm going to give him a solid B for many of the same reasons. I think Obama... His lacking foreign policy experience, I think, really showed with his initial dealings with China. Like you said about the pivot, I think it was an accurate identification. It was kind of an early identification. But again, the lacking punishments for cyber espionage and IPT really bring down my grade. Talking about economics, I think it was good that he tried to force China to play by the world economic rules, but I think it's pretty clear that didn't work when we start talking about curbing China's environmental and labor abuses, their trade inequalities, and the lacking transparency. But at the end of the day, criticizing Obama for being some kind of apologist or weak is not entirely accurate or fair.
Yeah, I think that's a fair overview of China. And with that finished, let's move on to Japan. Now, Japan is probably America's biggest ally in the Pacific. It's been this way since the Treaty of Mutual Cooperation and Security was signed in 1960. But during Obama's first term, Japan looked like it was drifting away from the U.S. and investing more in its relations with China. That's a big red flag, obviously. Obama's rebalance to Asia led to some noteworthy examples of cooperation between the U.S. and Japan and really brought Japan back closer to America.
Yeah, so there are a few examples of success in pulling Japan back, but I'm going to highlight two. The first was the earthquake tsunami disaster, which led to the Fukushima nuclear crisis. The U.S. actually moved very quickly to help contain and then rebuild the affected areas. The second point, and probably the more important one, there was a Japanese-Chinese crisis that happened. We're talking about the East China Sea around the Senkaku Islands to the Japanese or the Diu Islands to the Chinese. Now, Obama committed, like, doubled down 100%. He committed to an alliance response with Japan.
Yeah, this response is actually huge in the grand scheme of things. Obama openly stated in 2014 that he considered the islands covered by the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. That was the first time a president did that, and it's really a big reassurance to the Japanese.
And it was also pretty antagonistic to China. A strong U.S.-Japan alliance factored into Chinese accusations of an American containment policy.
Fair point, but that is the price Obama paid to bolster the U.S.-Japanese partnership. I mean, look at what he got in return. The U.S. and Japan revised their military guidelines to increase coordination. Japan was a big initial supporter of the TPP when negotiations were first taking place. Abe didn't close the Marine base in Okinawa, even though there were massive demonstrations to kick U.S. forces out. And really, it just kind of solidified that key security relationship.
Yeah, okay. I can take that. Those are all very true points. So let's just give our grades then, right? I think this was an A. I love Obama's policy towards Japan, specifically that he took a very diplomatic approach in building it up over the years. and we didn't talk about it, but I appreciate that he was the first sitting president to visit Hiroshima, and I'm pretty sure Abe was the first prime minister to visit or sitting prime minister to visit Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, that's the diplomatic point right there is good, because I'm pretty sure Abe is considered a very tough negotiator and somebody who's not that easy to work with. And the fact that Obama navigated that situation really with class and grace and did a really good job is something to highlight. I think you could make a claim or a case for some realism that maybe using Japan to be antagonistic towards China isn't in the best interest of the United States. But that's a stretch. I mean, that's just me picking straws. I think this is very well handled, and I think it gets an A. Since we're geographically close, let's pivot to the Korean Peninsula and start with the North Koreans.
Yeah, I didn't expect you to choose North Korea first. Wow, that's a shocker.
The interesting one. In 2009, North Korea was conducting unannounced warhead and missile testing. Welcome into office, Mr. Obama. Meanwhile, the president was ramping up military cooperation with South Korea by undoing a 40% reduction of troops on the ground that was put in place by Bush. And we also had the sinking of a South Korean Navy vessel around this time, which was said to be attributed to North Korea. So not the best situation to walk into.
And that's all very escalatory, right? And things then continue to get worse.
Yes, they do. Mostly around 2012, when Kim Jong-un really comes into power, he's going about his normal business, testing missiles and threatening the United States with talks and poorly edited videos of ICBMs.
And obviously, those did not go over well.
No, not really the best idea. The Pentagon briefed at the time that North Korea now posed a serious threat to the United States, South Korea, and Japan. And we also have our friend John Kerry running around to any international institution that will listen to him, stating that North Korea cannot be accepted as a nuclear power. Then between 2013 and 2014, North Korea arrests and imprisons at least three Americans. This results in its own outcry that includes the likes of Dennis Rodman being involved in the process to fix things. Ultimately, sanctions were proposed by the Senate but not ratified, and Obama publicly said he thinks that the Kim dynasty will collapse.
Are you ready for my hot take here?
Let's hear it.
I think Dennis Rodman should be the next Secretary of State.
You ready for my hot take?
Go ahead.
You do a better job than Hillary Clinton. That is tongue-in-cheek, everyone, for the record. With that aside, let's talk about the interview and the Sony hacks, because believe it or not, this is a big deal for the administration.
Yeah, so Sony was putting out a movie titled The Interview, in which a CIA plot to assassinate Kim Jong-un takes place with a slightly graphic death scene for their dear leader.
Now they blew his face off.
I didn't actually see it. Did that happen?
I don't think it made the final cut.
Oh, okay. So North Korea is clearly not pleased. I mean, who would be? They hack into Sony. They leave some threatening messages. They steal some movies and some scripts. They dump it all on WikiLeaks and also make some threats that any theaters who do play the movie risk some violence.
Yeah, and the U.S. responds with a pretty heavy hand. Obama is clear and strong in saying that no country will impede on freedom of speech and expression, and then DDoSes North Korea and shuts all 27 or so of their websites down for 24 hours. Doesn't sound like much because they're not really an internet-heavy or interconnected society, but it's likely that missile detection systems were offline for a period of time. That is pretty serious, especially when you're a rogue state with nuclear weapons.
And to conclude, by the end of Obama's tenure, North Korean-USA relations are pretty bleak, to say the least. Kim Jong-un is on the U.S. list of sanctioned individuals, and the North Koreans are just generally not happy with the U.S. During this 8-year period, there's a lot of jawing, there's a lot of tit-for-tat between the North Koreans and the Americans.
Yeah, this is kind of what drags down Obama's handling of North Korea. I like the presence or the strength he showed in terms of reaffirming freedom of speech and expression, and the cyber attacks are obviously heavily important in the cyber timeline of things, but we're just getting involved with every little detail with North Korea, and that just makes me a little uncomfortable.
I agree. I'm going to give this a B+. I like the strong cyber reaction that Obama had to North Korea and the Sony hacks. I think that was a good precedent to set. I don't like that we got involved in a tit-for-tat scenario. It kind of gives North Korea some legitimacy when America starts acknowledging every little thing that they do. Also, during the 8 years, North Korea did prop up its nuclear program, and I feel like there could have been something to stifle that more, to head it off. But in general, I'm going to give Obama a B+ handling North Korea.
Yeah, I'm somewhere around a B minus. So tell me a little bit about South Korea now.
You know, not too many important events happened here. We should emphasize that South Korea is very much in the thought process around the pivot to the Pacific. Maintaining a strong alliance similar to Japan was a big focal point. You mentioned earlier about the troop increase on the Korean Peninsula. And we should also make note of that in 2010, Obama identified South Korea as a cornerstone of U.S. security.
Yeah, that's really the best way to sum it up. Nothing really gradable here, but still important to factor into the pivot as a whole. And just give credit where credit's due about the work President Obama did to reassure the alliance and make sure that South Korea is comfortable under the security umbrella of the United States.
So I guess I'm not going to give a specific grade for South Korea.
No, me neither.
I think it kind of is like a Japan or a kind of grade.
Japan with no real examples to support our grade.
Yes. So let's just get into our overall then. What's your number?
So I'm somewhere between like a 2.6 and a 2.8. So I'm going to settle with another C+ for President Obama's handling of the rest of foreign policy.
Okay, I'm slightly above you. President Obama came in at a 3.0, flat B here. Why did he get a C+ for you?
Okay, so I have an F on my grade tally, which
That's
really
true.
Breaks
That's
things
true.
Down. And for me, there's a couple things that stick out. I don't really think the Chinese or East Asian policy itself deserves a C+. It's probably somewhere around a B-, but the whole handling of reset is just F, and everything with Russia is F, with Crimea. I think this is another example where the term we used last week was auxiliary states, right? In this case, Obama handled the auxiliary states pretty well and the auxiliary international institutions. He did pretty well with NATO. He did pretty well with places like South Korea and Japan, and relatively well with North Korea. But in terms of China and Russia, it just kind of drags the overall thing down. Those handling of the big power nations really wasn't that good. The pivot, I think, pivoted too hard. And we left Russia on the back burner too much. That comes back to bite us in the butt pretty quickly. But yeah, that's kind of why I'm at where I'm at. I mean, I don't think it's bad. We'll look back after we do all of these foreign policy reviews, and Obama probably could be pretty close to the top.
So I think that President Obama displayed a great amount of promise in his initial policy proposals, dealing specifically with the Russian reset and the pivot to the Pacific. The Russian reset, as I said earlier in the episode, there was a lot of diplomatic progress made initially. However, I think that, like we said when we covered Russian new generation warfare, there were signs, there were indications that Russia was going to do something again or evolve in some way. And I don't think that the follow through on the Russian reset adequately addressed what Russia was going to do, which I give Obama credit for his Russian reset dreams, but the follow through and the lack of response when we're talking about Ukraine brings it down. Talking about the pivot to the Pacific, I think it was an absolutely great idea. Focus on the rising China, reestablish and reassure the security alliances with South Korea and Japan, build new ones. We didn't even talk about India, the Philippines, Australia, New Zealand. But the follow-through is not as strong. So I think overall, Obama kind of walked the line. He did things really well. He showed a lot of promise, but his follow-through was not as strong.
Almost like it looks good on paper, but the execution isn't sufficient.
Yeah, and I think this is all very indicative of Obama's lack of foreign policy experience when he came into office.
But he is a good politician to get the ball rolling in the first place on some of these very, very intricate and detailed issues, right?
Absolutely. We have to give him credit where credit is due, but also knock him where he deserves to be knocked.
And it'll be fair to evaluate him after we've done a couple others to see where he stacks up against other presidents in our lifetime and before.
Yeah, I get maybe we'll do like a general wrap up of all of the overall grades from across the presidents that we cover.
Yeah, so tell us what you think about Obama's foreign policy. I think this one is one of the most interesting to debate because it's so recent, right? It lives in our memory pretty close. We're on Twitter at DownTRH.
You can email us at downtrh.pod@gmail.com.
And you can find us on all of your favorite podcast listening platforms, Spotify, Apple, Google, whatever else is out there. But we will see you next week with something else.
Yeah. But until then, we'll see you on Twitter.